All right, good morning, everybody. I won't see you again before Thanksgiving, so happy Thanksgiving. Please don't show up to class. I had a serious question one of the other lab periods. Is class really, campus really closed on Thursday? And what is the answer?
Yes,
it is. I think for the past 300 years it's been closed on Thanksgiving Day, so I know you're enthusiastic, but the campus is closed. All right, so I did put on Blackboard, and I emailed you, and I put in course information, everybody's grade, so you can find your grades. All right, so I'm going to have to yell, shut up, because some people might be interested in hearing this. All right, who's talking up there? Smack who's ever talking up in the back there. All right, so you got to make sure that, I don't know if you've had, I didn't get any emails, so I figured everybody can figure out how to read this. How do you find your grade? Please look in the first column for your score on the first test. Let's see. So let's say it's all pretty easy to find so far. I don't see any duplicate grades. All right. Well, just find your grade on the first exam. Maybe you got an 82.2. All right. But who else got an 82.2? Three other people got an 82.2. So how are you going to find your row? Go over to the next column and find your score in the next column, and maybe you got an 82.1 on the next test. So guess what? This is your row all the way across. Right? So you can double check your grades right there. These first four columns, and actually there's going to be a fifth one, this is the percentage that you got on the exams, and percent equal course points for tests. Each test is worth 100 points, and of course, if you get it all right on that first test, that's 100%. All right, then we've got lab percentage in this column right here. So here is the maximum number. There's if you got 100% on all the tests and quizzes and essays or whatever you had to do in lab, right, that's going to be worth 160 points according to the syllabus, right? So multiply this percentage by 160, and that should correspond to this number right here. All right, so in order to calculate your overall grade, add your lab points to your exam points, and that's what we have in this column, to date course points. And what's the maximum so far? 560. All right, so this 160 points for lab just assumes that you're going to do about as well in lab on the last quiz or last two quizzes that you've been doing all semester. All right, so this is a projected lab quiz score. Right, it might vary a little bit, but not very much at this point. Add those numbers together, all right, divide by 560, and that will give you the to-date course percent. And the grading scale is what? Just a 90, 80, 70, 60. Okay, and then I just assign grades by whatever percentage that you have right here. All right, so that's your grades. And then the last four columns are kind of fun because it will tell you what you need to do on the final exam for an A, a B, C, or a D. So for this person right here that's got 100% in the class, they only have to get a 34% on the final to get an A. And even if they don't take the final, right, since this is a negative number, they get a B in the class, even if they don't take it, because they can give away 32 points and still get a B. Same thing for a C or a D. So here's some more good students. Here's a student that only needs to get a 45.5% on the final. And no matter what they do, right, they can't earn a negative 20 points in the class at this point in time. So there's no way for them not to get at least a B in the class. That's pretty nice. All right, now I do want to caution everybody, especially maybe this student right here that only needs a 41 on the final for an A. I would still study just like the other tests. Because I've had a lot of students, for instance, in this particular case, as an example, get a 39 or a 40 on the final and then get a B in the class. Well, that would be terrible to give away a really super grade in a class, right? Just because you think you can get a marginal score without studying at all. So please study for that last test, right? So a lot of times I don't like even to give this information out because people kind of slack off a little bit. All right, so that's how you would read all of that information, and then I put a couple checks in there just to make sure that's correct. So what did this person get on the first test? 90 in the second test? And a third test? Fourth test? 90? All right, and lab, what do they get in lab? 90. Okay, so we run this through. So what do you think, what's intuitive? What do you think a person needs to get on the final to get an A in the class? If they have an exact 90% right now? 90. And is that true? Yeah, that's what they need to do on the final. Okay, so you can trust this information. Then they only need 24 points for a B in the class. All right, so you can look this over. If these lecture scores aren't correct, the exam scores, please let me know, and I'll update it sooner or later. All right, so that's one kind of handy thing about Blackboard. Oh, good, I didn't close it out. All right, so we were still in the cardiovascular chapter. Does anybody have any questions about cardiovascular system so far? I think we're doing pretty good. I want to be able to draw some things on the board, and that chapter is chapter 14. So we were still looking at Poiseuille's equation, or Poiseuille's law, last time. So what does that tell us? What does Poiseuille's law tell us? You should be familiar with some basic concept of Poiseuille's law, and of course all these other things that we're talking about. Let's see, last time we also talked about the three hormones that help regulate blood pressure. What were the names of the three hormones? Okay, let me pay attention to what you're saying. Okay, what are they? ADH, antidiuretic hormone, is one. Aldosterone is two. Atrial-natriuretic hormone, number three. And you should know which ones are antagonistic to each other, which ones are responsible for raising blood pressure, which ones are more responsible for lowering blood pressure. Okay? And they all, basically all work through regulating blood volume, right? By regulating the kidneys to make you pee or not pee so much, that increases or decreases blood volume, which increases or decreases venous return to the heart, which then has an effect on contractility of the heart because of the important effect of end-diastolic volume on myocardial function, myocardial contractility. So as the heart stretches in a normal heart, what happens to force of contraction? Okay, the force of contraction increases due to what? That Frank Starling law of the heart. All right. Now if your heart is failing, that works against you. Then you're on the descending limb of that Frank Starling curve. All right, so we're still just looking at some physical properties of flow, fluid flow, through any kind of system, and that's Poiseuille's equation. So let's take a look. I hear a little mumbling and murmuring. We probably want to do that because some people really want to pay attention to this because it's not intuitive. All right, so it's really important. Go ahead, step outside for just a second. All right, so blood flow. I'm just going to abbreviate it BF, blood flow. And what are the units of blood flow?
Heart rate.
Okay, those are things that we multiply together to get blood flow. So blood flow actually could be considered cardiac output. And that is what? A volume of blood per time. And what's the typical good volume that we like to use? Okay, would we want to measure in like gallons? Milliliters, perfect. All right, so milliliters. So this is going to be equal to milliliters per minute because we still like to use minutes. That's a reasonable period of time for us. What's another way that we can measure a milliliter? What the heck is a milliliter really? What's a milliliter in terms of, you know, a cube? Oh, I wanted to draw this before class. All right, what's a milliliter? Okay, it's 1 centimeter, 1 centimeter, and 1 centimeter. All right, so that's the same thing as what? Cubic centimeter. So a milliliter is cubic centimeters. All right, it's just those three dimensions multiplied by each other. All right, so blood flow. What the heck is equal to blood flow? That's going to be, what makes a fluid flow from one place to another? Pressure. Yeah, pressure difference. And is it directly related or inversely related? Directly related. As pressure increases, what happens to blood flow? It increases as well, right? So let's put pressure, where does it belong? In the, okay, anybody familiar with this term? The numerator, right? So we're going to put blood pressure here, right? And don't forget in your book, sometimes they call that delta P. It's a pressure difference between two different places. All right, so blood flow is equal to blood pressure, but there's something else that we have to consider. There is impedance to blood flow. There's something that's going to stop blood flow, even though we have blood pressure, and that is resistance, right? And we're just going to call that R, the resistance to blood flow, right? And this is where Poiseuille made some very nice improvements in our thinking, because what the heck is this resistance going to be equal to? What is resistance? How about viscosity? Okay. Viscosity. As viscosity increases, what happens to resistance? It increases. It's directly related. What the heck is the symbol for viscosity? I think it's this eta symbol. Can I draw it? Something like that. Okay. That's viscosity. All right. And as the length of the tube increases, what happens to resistance, would you guess? So it should be directly related once again, right? So we're going to put an L right here. And resistance is also going to be related to the radius of that tube. So as the tube gets thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner, consider vasoconstriction, what happens to resistance? Okay. Okay, as the diameter gets bigger, 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 what happens to resistance? Decrease. Then it decreases. That's the best way to think about that. All right, so let's put resistance and the radius, little r, right here to the fourth power. All right, so of all these parameters right here, which of these parameters can be adjusted in your body? Viscosity of your blood? Hopefully not. Length of blood vessels? Not unless somebody stretches you out like twice your length. That would be pretty weird. But the radius of blood vessels can be controlled in your body all over the place by smooth muscle, right? By smooth muscle in arterioles in particular control that. All right, so this is radius. And there's some proportionality constants that you see right there, like pi and a number 8 and things like that. So we could put this number in right over here into this equation, right? So let's go ahead and do that. So we're going to see blood flow. I'll carry blood flow down over here. So blood flow is equal to blood pressure divided by this eta L divided by radius to the fourth power. Well, that looks kind of complicated. So where would we like to put this radius to the fourth power? Right, so it's a little algebraic manipulation. This radius to the fourth power, right, can actually go in the numerator right here. All right, so if we multiply the top and the bottom by radius to the fourth power, what's radius to the fourth power over radius to the fourth power equal to? That's just one. We can multiply any equation by one, and when we do that, the radius ends up here next to blood pressure. Okay, so that's Poiseuille's equation, right, which includes resistance. So that's just a little manipulation of this equation right here. So be familiar with what's the most important factor in determining blood flow through a particular circuit in the body. It is the radius of a blood vessel, and that can be regulated very nicely through the sympathetic nervous system. Okay, and that, of course, is Poiseuille's equation. All right, so let's figure out what's going to happen to blood flow if we double the radius, if we double the radius of a blood vessel. If sympathetic tone decreases and then blood pressure is going to allow that blood vessel to expand to twice its radius, what's going to happen to blood flow? It's going to be, so the radius is going to change by a factor of 2,
So, but it's not just a factor of two in terms of blood flow. It's two times, two times, two times, two times. Oh, it's just four. All right. So what's that number? Two times two is four, times two is eight, times two is 16. So it changes by a factor of 16 when the radius of that blood vessel only doubles in size. So it's a very powerful way to change blood flow to different parts of the body just by controlling vasoconstriction or vasodilation. Okay. All right, so here we have a plot of blood pressure versus a number of places in the cardiovascular system. So here we have the left ventricle, and when the left ventricle is in diastole, what's the pressure in the left ventricle? You can read it right off this chart right here. Okay, when the ventricle's in diastole, hopefully I said diastole, what's the pressure? Right here by the cursor. What's this cursor right here say? Can you read this line? Yeah, it's zero. Right, so the pressure actually goes to zero in the left ventricle when it's in diastole, which means what? Blood is going to flow into it, right? And during systole, what's the pressure? It goes up to 120, right? So you were tested on this already. So this is just some pressure curves with very low time resolution. We don't see the nice fancy shape that it goes through, the dichrotic notch or any of that, of left ventricular pressure. And then blood goes from the left ventricle into the aorta, and you could say any kind of large artery. And what's a normal blood pressure, or what should it be? 120 over 80, and we see this on the graph right here, so that's a nice normal blood pressure, 120 over 80. 120 the systolic, 80 is the diastolic pressure. All right, and then as blood flows into smaller blood vessels, oh, I tell you what, these large arteries, what can you remember about large arteries from anatomy? What's their histology like? What's the composition of the different tunics like? And what are they called, these large arteries close to the heart? They're called conducting arteries loaded with elastic tissue, so that when the ventricle pumps high pressure, large volume of blood into the aorta actually expands, and then as the pressure decreases, that elastic tissue does what? It constricts the artery, maintains blood pressure a little bit, and forces that blood into small arteries and arterioles. These small arteries and arterioles don't have as much elastic tissue. They do have, however, more smooth muscle that can regulate the radius. All right, so there's a lot of resistance in these smaller vessels. We call these, in anatomy, what did we call these? No longer conducting arteries, but distributing arteries, distributing blood flow all over the place. Okay, so there is a large drop in pressure in small arteries and arterioles, and that's due to a decrease in the radius of these blood vessels. Right, so the resistance increases. All right, then blood gets into capillaries. Blood flows from the proximal end to the distal end of a capillary because why? How would you, on this graph right here, how could you describe that blood is actually going to flow from a proximal end to a distal end of a capillary? What do you see on this graph? At the proximal end, we have what? About 30 millimeters of mercury. At the distal end, we have less than 20 millimeters of mercury. We have what? A delta P, which is the motivating force for blood flow. There's a pressure difference. So blood is going to flow from the proximal to the distal end. And then how does blood get back to the heart? Because again, there's a pressure difference, so blood will flow back to the heart. These veins and venules contain most of the blood in your body, about 60%, right? But they also contain a lot of smooth muscle. So these can constrict to return that blood to the heart. When it constricts, what happens to the heart? When these capacitance blood vessels, we call these capacitance because they hold a lot of blood, when they vasoconstrict and all of a sudden all that blood goes back to the heart dilates, what happens to the heart? How does it respond? It gets stronger in contraction, so now it pumps more blood to your body, right, because of that Frank-Starling law. So it works really nice. All right, the other thing that you should be aware of in this graph right here is what blood vessels have the lowest blood pressure? But let me set you up for confusion so you can think it through. What is the what's the most functional vessel that we're looking at here and why? If I don't want to just look at the structure, but if I want to think of function, which one of these blood vessels might play the biggest role in your body?
Capillary.
The capillaries. That's interesting. Why would you say capillary? Because that is where exchange takes place. That's where things can leave the blood, go to tissues, and that's where tissues can put things into the circulatory system for transport. So capillaries play a prime role in the functioning of the cardiovascular system. All right, so knowing that, where, let me ask you a question about blood pressure. What blood vessels have the highest blood pressure? Would be large arteries. Which blood vessels have the lowest blood pressure? And you have to think, just don't say capillary, because capillaries are the important functional unit in the cardiovascular system, but the lowest blood pressure still has to be in the veins, right? Because if blood pressure in capillaries was the lowest, where would all the blood go? It would go from arteries to capillaries, but it would also go from veins to capillaries, and then what would happen? Well, it'd just be a really big mess because all those capillaries would get filled with blood and they'd just explode all over the place, right? So that can't happen, right? So make sure somebody asks you, what vessels have the lowest blood pressure? You're going to say veins, not capillaries. But there is something else interesting about capillaries. Let's look at this slide right here. We have a slide of the cross-sectional area, all right? We have centimeters squared right here. How do I know this is a surface area? Because how would you measure the surface area of something? It's the height of something times the width. All right, like the surface, what was the surface area of that door? Did we ever measure that yet in this class? We haven't yet. Okay. How about the surface area of a piece of paper? What would be the surface area of a piece of paper? 8.5 inches times 11. You could calculate the surface area. All right, so we could calculate the surface area of all of these blood vessels, like the aorta. All right, the aorta is what? Does it have a really small diameter or a large diameter? It's a large diameter, but how many aortas do you have? You only got one. So it's not a very large surface area because you only have one aorta. The surface area of the circulatory system, you can see, does what as you go from the aorta to arteries to arterioles? It increases. All right, the diameter actually decreases, but now instead of just having one, you have hundreds, and then finally you have thousands, and then finally you have millions of these blood vessels, even though they have a small diameter. If we add all of those small diameters up, the cross-sectional area increases. So if you look at that cross-sectional area, which blood vessels, if we add them all up together, has the largest cross-sectional area? It is the capillaries, right? And then it starts to decrease again as you get down to the vena cava, because the vena cava you only have one of. Okay. Well, there is a law, we're not going to get into this law, that describes if you have a certain amount of blood flow, okay, through a tube, and as the cross-sectional area increases, then that velocity of blood through these tubes has to decrease as the cross-sectional area increases. So this first graph, we see capillaries have the most cross-sectional area. If we look at this second graph over here, right, and we're using the same blood vessels that we see up on the top, but now we have centimeters per second. What the heck is centimeters per second? Okay, here we have blood flow, cardiac output equals to milliliters per minute, and what was that equal to? Centimeters cubed per minute. All right, but what do we have on the screen? Centimeters per second. So there's a time unit, but what is centimeters per second? It's just a length. All right, what do we call that going a distance per time, a length per time? That's velocity. That's not blood flow, right, because that's volume per time. But just a distance per time is velocity. So let's look at this graph of the velocity of blood. It even says it on this slide right here. Velocity. Okay? Which vessels have the slowest velocity? It's the capillaries, right? Because they have the highest cross-sectional area. So the velocity of blood in a capillary is the slowest, and it's the highest in arteries, and it's pretty high in veins again. Okay. Now, that's good that you see it on this graph. You should memorize that if you can't read this graph right here. Why is it important for capillaries to have the slowest velocity? Because what's happening there? Exchange is happening there, right? It wouldn't do you any good to get a bunch of blood into a capillary if it was just going to scoot through and not spend any time in the capillary, right? So capillaries, blood gets into a capillary, and what does it do? It spends time in the capillary because it has the slowest velocity that allows for exchange. Okay, and so that's due to the total cross-sectional area of blood. You may or may not have this picture in your book. You know, I can't remember. I think this is, you know what? You don't have that picture in your book. And shame on your book, so I give it to you anyway. All right, because I want you to know that the velocity of blood is slow in capillaries, which allows for exchange. And it's slow because of this cross-sectional area. All right, blood pressure. So let's change our ways of thinking just a little bit about and go to blood pressure. And what's blood pressure going to be equal to? We've got cardiac output or blood flow equal to blood pressure divided by resistance to flow, right? So here's blood pressure. So we're going to be interested in blood pressure right here. Okay, we said arterioles play a big role in distributing blood to various parts of your body, and that's why in anatomy we had to memorize that small arteries and arterioles are what we call distributing arteries, as opposed to conducting arteries, which are large diameter blood vessels like the aorta. Okay, so arterioles play a big role in controlling blood pressure. Okay, blood flow to capillaries and blood pressure is controlled by the diameter of arterioles, right? That's Poiseuille's equation. Right, capillary blood pressure is decreased because they're downstream of high resistance arterioles. So if we go back, go back. Right, look at this big drop in blood pressure because small arteries and arterioles have the most resistance in all blood vessels in your circulatory system. This is the biggest drop in blood pressure due to these arterioles. And that's because they can vasoconstrict and some can vasodilate at the same time. So this right here is just an illustration that tries to show that. And you sort of did something like this in lab. Okay, we can maintain pressure, right, because gravity is pulling on the fluid in this tube and it kind of looks like blood in this tube, right? So we can maintain pressure in this system by keeping this tube filled up at a particular height. Right? Oh, good, the little hourglass went away. Okay, by keeping fluid at this certain level, so that's going to exert a pressure, and that pressure is going to move fluid through these different tubes. Right? And as you move through this tube, what happens to the pressure? We can look at pressure at this region here, compare it to this region right here, and compare it to this region right here by looking at what? The height of blood in this tube and compared to the height in this tube compared to the height in this tube. Okay, so what can you tell me about the pressure right here compared to right here? Is it exactly the same? Nope, it's a little bit less right here because there is a little bit of resistance in this tube, right? Because this tube has automatic updates. No, we don't want to restart now. Later. Okay. So we got a bunch of smart computers now. They're all talking to each other. Even though it's time to update and all that, we can wait till later. All right, so because there's a little bit of resistance right here, we lose some pressure. All right, now what can you tell me about the resistance as you go from this point here to this point here compared to resistance in this part of the tube? The resistance is increased because why? We're constricting, right? We're vasoconstricting right here. So the radius is decreasing. So that decreases the pressure. And can you see a big difference in blood pressure? Absolutely. Right through here. All right. So if we release this constriction, right, then of course we're going to have more blood pressure over here, which means that this thing is going to increase, right? And if we're going to allow for flow, then we can adjust the amount of flow through this circuit by adjusting the diameter of this vessel right here, right? And so this is what the job of arterioles is all the time in your body. Blood can flow from muscles to digestive organs based on vasoconstricting arterioles that are supplying those circulations. All right, so right now you're probably more in a fed state than an exercise state, unless you just came from a PE class. All right, so where is most of the blood going in your body? Is it going to muscles, or is it going to your digestive system? Probably your digestive system, right? Because vascular beds that are controlled by arterioles that are going to muscles are vasoconstricting at the moment, therefore maintaining blood pressure to other important organs that you have. And as a matter of fact, let's just say that this is all the blood that you have in your body, and let's release this constriction right here, right? So that will increase blood flow to muscles, but what's going to happen now to these other circuits? There's going to be a decrease in blood pressure a little bit. You know, so that if we open up all the blood vessels in your body, and you just don't have three, but you have millions, if all of your arterioles were to vasodilate, you don't have enough blood to go everywhere in your body, and your blood pressure would plummet. So your body has to pick where does that blood flow go, and it will vasoconstrict certain arterioles to maintain blood pressure. So this is a pretty good slide to look at. All right, but we kind of talked about this slide already. Capillary blood pressure is also low, okay, because of the large total cross-sectional area. So here is just a cross-sectional area of different blood vessels, namely capillaries, which is illustrated by all these capillary tubes that we see right here. Okay, and we can also see a large decrease in blood pressure across the capillary because there's a high resistance in those blood vessels. All right, now this is a slide that I need to talk about a lot. Okay. Blood pressure. Are we interested in understanding blood pressure in people? Absolutely, right? Because hypertension is so important. Hypotension can be an important disease process that has to be controlled in people. And people might be losing blood pressure on the way to the hospital, of course. And when you don't have any blood pressure, blood isn't going to flow the various organs in your body, and it's going to kill those organs, like your kidney, right, your brain, your liver, and organs like that. So we got to be able to maintain a person's blood pressure. So there are three parameters that control blood pressure in somebody. It's controlled by heart rate, stroke volume, and also peripheral resistance. And when you see this term peripheral resistance, you should just think of resistance. Peripheral just means resistance outside of the heart. All right, so what equation does that kind of remind you of? What's heart rate and stroke volume? What can those be used to calculate? Cardiac output, right? Cardiac output is equal to heart rate times stroke volume. And cardiac output is the same thing as blood flow. Right, so, and what are the units? Milliliters per minute, right? All right, so as cardiac output increases, all right, and if resistance stays the same, if cardiac output increases, resistance stays the same, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up because they are what? Directly related to each other, right? So thinking directly related or inversely related are powerful ways of thinking. All right, what's not intuitive is that peripheral resistance term. All right, so let's rearrange these equations a little bit. So maybe I'm going to erase some of this. We don't need Fazui's equation necessarily. Okay. All right, so guess what we're going to do now? A little algebra, but not too bad. All right, so we got what? Cardiac output is equal to heart rate times stroke volume. All right, and so don't forget that's blood flow. Well, what else is blood flow equal to? So blood flow, what do I want to put? Blood flow or cardiac output? You know what? I'll put blood flow right here, cardiac output. Okay, so I'll say cardiac output or blood flow is going to be equal to something else. What else is blood flow going to be equal to? Besides these parameters on the hearts, how about some parameters of the blood vessels? Let's include that right now. Why does blood flow from one region to another? Due to blood pressure. So let's put BP right here. Cardiac output, all right, blood flow is going to be directly related to blood pressure, but it's also going to be inversely related to what? Resistance. Okay, and maybe I'll just put an R right here. All right, so what do we got? We got this right here. And we want to solve for resistance, because that's what we're trying to consider, to get an intuitive sense for if resistance changes, what happens to blood pressure. All right, so let's get resistance on one side of the equation, okay, which is going to look like what? Blood pressure. Okay, so blood pressure is equal to resistance times cardiac output, just by rearranging that equation. All right, blood pressure, cardiac output. So we got resistance right here, and what's cardiac output equal to? Heart rate times stroke volume. That's equal to what? Blood pressure. So what can you tell me about resistance and heart rate and stroke volume? How do they relate to blood pressure? They're all directly related. So if heart rate goes up, what happens to blood pressure? Goes up. If heart rate goes down, what happens to blood pressure? Goes down. All right. If stroke volume goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up, right, because it's directly related. And if resistance goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up as well. Okay. So maybe you need to just memorize this equation right here, but that's what we said on the very first line of this slide right here. But maybe if you can do some of this algebra, it might be a little bit more intuitive for you to see that resistance is directly related to blood pressure. Okay? Okay, now how can that resistance be adjusted? All right, so here the slide says, an increase at any of these variables will result in an increase in blood pressure. And now you can prove it to yourself. Right, starting with those two simple equations, cardiac output equals heart rate times stroke volume, and cardiac output is equal to blood pressure divided by resistance, combining these two. Sympathetic tone raises blood pressure, right? And when I say sympathetic tone, your book calls that sympathoadrenal activity, meaning that the adrenal medulla can release epinephrine and norepinephrine into the blood. That's going to cause vasoconstriction of arterioles, and some arterioles are innervated by sympathetic nerves that will cause vasoconstriction. Okay, so as what happens to resistance when blood vessels vasoconstrict? What happens to resistance? It increases. What happens to blood pressure when blood vessels vasoconstrict? Blood pressure increases. Okay, so that raises blood pressure via arterial vasoconstriction and by increasing cardiac output. Because as sympathetic nerves go to the heart, what happens to heart rate? Increases. That's a positive chronotropic effect. Sympathetic nerves go to the heart. Do they affect stroke volume? Yeah, because they go to the ventricles. Right, so stroke volume increases, so sympathetic activity really increases blood pressure because it increases resistance and it increases cardiac output as well through heart rate and stroke volume. All right, they're very insistent. Let's make them go away. Okay, kidney also plays an important role in blood pressure by regulating blood volume. All right, so as the kidneys make you retain fluid, your blood volume increases, That means you have more venous return going back to the heart. And as you have more venous return to the heart, what happens to the heart? Does it shrink or stretch? Stretches. What happens to the contractility of the heart as it stretches? It increases. That increases stroke volume. Right? So as you retain fluids in your body, your blood pressure goes up as well because of the effect on stroke volume of the heart, if you have a normal heart. All right, so that's all really good things to become a little bit aware of. And what was the mechanism that we said that was the most important mechanism for regulating long-term blood pressure in our bodies? The dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, right? That you should be able to draw out from memory, and then if you see that exam figure on the test, then it'll be really easy for you, right? So draw that out from memory. So the long-term regulation for blood pressure is maintained by hormones that interact with each other in the body, but those aren't very good for adjusting blood pressure minute to minute or even second to second. So for instance, right now you're sitting down and after class you're going to jump up because holidays are about to start and you want to get out of here, all right? And as you jump up, your blood pressure is going to plummet. And if your blood pressure isn't maintained through homeostatic mechanisms, you're going to pass out, all right? And then what's going to happen? Well, your head's going to hit the table, bounce once, maybe then the chair bounce a couple times, and then the floor a couple times, right? That's really not a good thing. So there's got to be another mechanism that maintains your blood pressure in the very short term, second to second, and that's what we call the baroreceptor reflex. So do you think this baroreceptor reflex is an endocrine or a hormone or chemically regulated mechanism or a neuronal mechanism? Which one has a faster onset? Yeah, neuronal reflexes have faster onsets, but that also means that they don't last for very long. But that's okay because they're so fast, they can be regulated very quickly, right? So the baroreceptor reflex is the most important control mechanism for short-term regulation of blood pressure. So you should know that, just memorize that. Long-term is renin-angiotensin-aldosterone. Short-term is baroreceptor. One is endocrine, the other is nervous reflex. Okay. All right, so the baroreceptor reflex is activated by changes in blood pressure. That's what the controlling parameter is. And in order for your body to make adjustments in blood pressure, what does it need? How does the response loop always start? It starts with a stimulus, but in order to appreciate that stimulus, what does your body have to have? It's got to have a receptor, right? So you need receptors or sensory system for monitoring blood pressure, and that's called a baroreceptor. You have pressure receptors in a couple places of your body, and there's stretch receptors located in the aortic arch and the carotid sinuses. Right, the aortic arch is what kind of blood vessel again? Okay, it's a conducting, which means it's highly elastic. As pressure goes up, what happens to the aorta? It vasodilates or it stretches, so there are stretch receptors that measure the stretch of the aorta, and as the aorta stretches, your mind knows or your brain knows that the pressure is increasing just by the amount of stretch. They're directly related to each other. The carotid sinus is just as important. Now, who knows where the carotid sinus is? Sometimes in anatomy, we don't go over that. I do, all right? But maybe not everybody does. So where the heck is the carotid sinus at? Here we got ascending aorta, arch, descending aorta. And we got, what, three branches coming off the aorta? All right, let's go to this one right here. What's this middle one? Okay, this one right here is going to be the left common carotid. So this goes to the head. This is subclavian. That goes to the left arm, right? So this goes up to the head, but you've got an inside your head compartment and an outside your head compartment, or cranial vault. You got some blood that goes into your brain, and you got other blood that goes to your face and facial muscles and things like that. So there's going to be a split in this blood vessel right here, right around this area. Right here, here's the split. What do we call a split in a blood vessel? bifurcation, right? So here is what? The external carotid artery, and here is the internal carotid. Hopefully I'm writing big enough for you guys in the back. All right, and this bifurcation right here is what we call the, anybody remember? This is the carotid sinus. Because it's like a little bulb, there's a little bulge right here. And this is where important stretch receptors are located. All right, so these stretch receptors monitor blood pressure that is going to your brain. Does that sound like a good idea? Do you need blood to go to your brain? Absolutely, right? You can't regulate, you don't have any homeostasis control over your body without your brain. Okay? So this area right here has stretch receptors. The arch of the aorta has stretch receptors that monitor systemic blood pressure. I don't know of any that measure pulmonary blood pressure, but that would be interesting if somebody could find some somewhere. All right, and this area of the body, the carotid sinus, which is right about here in people, is probably the most imaged area in the world because there's a lot of disease associated with that part of the body. All right, so when people are having strokes or transient ischemic attacks, ultrasounds are done of that area to see if there is any damage to blood vessels, if the blood vessels are constricted due to plaques. And it's terrible if plaques break off from the carotid sinus, because where would they go? Right to the brain and cause a stroke, right? So we're very interested in this area right here. And unfortunately, it becomes diseased very easily, all right? And it wrecks the baroreceptors. So don't press on those baroreceptors, because as you stretch them by pressing on them, what does your brain think is happening? Your pressure is skyrocketing, so your body is going to try to compensate for that by doing what? Lowering your blood pressure, and you might pass out. So, huh? So that could be like a sleeper hold you could put on somebody, okay? With just two fingers, you could probably make somebody pass out just by squeezing their baroreceptors, and I shouldn't do that, the carotid sinus.
When
you're being strangled. How interesting. Well, you probably die because you're restricting an airway, right? And that airway has to be open for, you know, in 3 minutes, yeah, you're a goner, right? Because you don't have any oxygen going up to your brain. Okay, so those are the baroreceptors. Aortic arch and carotid sinus. Open up your anatomy book. You know what? I think our anatomy book doesn't even have a carotid sinus labeled in it. Okay, so we should switch that book out too. All right, so an increase in blood pressure does what to the walls of these regions? It stretches them out. All right, so as these receptors stretch out, the frequency of action potentials that they're always generating increases. What does a train of action potential sound like in the brain? So I tell you what. You could tell me which person has a higher blood pressure. A person whose action potentials going to the brain sounds like case number one, blip, 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 or case number two, blip, 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 blip. Case number two, a higher frequency of action potentials going to your brain. Your brain says, oh, that's a high blood pressure. Okay? So baroreceptors send those action potentials to the vasomotor center and the cardiac control center. Sometimes we call it the cardioregulatory center, cardioregulatory center. These are, you learned in anatomy, in the medulla. All right, and the cardioregulatory center is most sensitive to a sudden decrease or sudden changes in blood pressure. All right, so they're phasic kinds of receptors. Right, they respond very quickly to sudden changes. So here we have, oh, here's a nice illustration. All right, here we've got a nice response loop that shows the heart. And what side of the heart is this where I have the cursor right now? Right ventricle, left ventricle. Look at this nice anterior longitudinal sulcus right here. So here is the right atrium. Here's the SA node, the AV node. Don't forget that's the pacemaker of the heart. So how does a response loop always start? With a stimulus. All right, and that's going to be a change in blood pressure on your systemic circulation, and say maybe an increase in blood pressure in the aorta. increase in blood pressure in the carotid sinus right here. But what's the, that's the stimulus. What's the next step in a response loop? Receptor, here are, what are these things right here? What do we call these receptors for blood pressure? Yeah, you could say stretch receptor, but typically they're called barrel receptors. They send action potentials to the medulla. So what do we call this right here in a response loop? All right, this is going to be the vagus and hypoglossal nerve. This is going to be the afferent pathway. And what do we call this center right here? Integration center. What does the integration center have? A set point. It has your normal blood pressure. Should be what? 120 over 80. So this information comes in. The set point's compared to the actual blood pressure and the cardioregulatory center, vasomotor center of the medulla make a decision on what to do. If the blood pressure is 120 over 80, what's the decision? Go back to what you're doing, right? Monday night football, whatever. All right, if it's different, right, if there's an error, then it has two choices. What are the two choices? One choice out the parasympathetic nervous system or the other through the sympathetic nervous system. Because what can you tell me about the relationship between parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system? Yeah, they're opposite to each other. They're antagonistic, right? All right, so if your blood pressure, let's just say, is too low, what will be the decision of the cardioregulatory center? Yeah, it should do what? It should, blood pressure too low, increase cardiac output by increasing heart rate and stroke volume. You do that with the sympathetic nervous system. Increase resistance of blood vessel. Again, that's with the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so the cardioregulatory center, vasomotor center, sends signals. What kind of outflow is this? Okay, this is thoracolumbar outflow because that is the sympathetic nervous system that has to go through the sympathetic chain. And we see it going to the heart, SA node to, that would be a positive chronotropic effect on heart. And it goes to the muscle right here, that's a positive inotropic effect, increasing both stroke volume and heart rate, increasing cardiac output, increasing blood pressure. And what you don't see are blood vessels going to arterioles causing vasoconstriction, which will also increase blood pressure. All right, but if the blood pressure is too high, what happens? All right, the stretch receptors send that to the cardioregulatory center. Cardioregulatory center says, oh, blood pressure is too high, we better get it back down. All right, and how do we get the blood pressure down? Now, for the parasympathetic nervous system, guess what? The only thing that your body can adjust is heart rate. Because that's the only place where the parasympathetic nervous system goes, and that is to the SA node. It doesn't go to blood vessels to cause vasodilation, doesn't go to the ventricular myocardium to decrease force of contraction, but it can decrease heart rate, and when you decrease heart rate and keep resistance and stroke volume the same, what happens to blood pressure? Because it goes down because why? How could you describe that? What's the relationship between heart rate and blood pressure? It's directly related, right? Okay, so that's the baroreceptor reflex. Do we have another slide? Oh, we have an exam figure. I've made it really trendy. Put the title on the side over here. Okay, because I couldn't get it to fit otherwise. So, make sure you can draw this one out too. All right, so when you go from supine position to standing position, all right, lying down to standing up, what's, do you have a feel for what might happen to your blood pressure? Should it stay the same, go up or go down? Okay, it's going to go down. Now, why does it go down? Because as you go from a lying position to standing position, blood is going to have a tendency to pool in your periphery. And as blood pools in your periphery, because that's where those capacitance venous blood vessels are, veins are, all right. As blood stays in your veins, what happens to venous return? It goes down. If blood is stuck in your periphery, venous return to the heart goes down. What happens to filling of the heart? It decreases. So the heart doesn't fill quite so much. right? And if it doesn't fill, that's what? End diastolic volume. If end diastolic volume goes down, what happens to the force of contraction of the heart? It decreases. The heart gets weaker as you stand up. Just when you don't want it to get weaker, it does. All right, so when that happens, stroke volume goes down, cardiac output goes down. You can relate it to our little equation right here. What happens to blood pressure? It drops as you stand up due to this mechanism right here. That is what we call the stimulus and our response loop. But that's okay in normal people because what can measure that decrease in blood pressure? Baroreceptors, which are located carotid sinus and the arch of the aorta, all right, and it's going to send signals via afferent pathway to the medulla oblongata, which has the cardioregulatory center and the vasomotor center right there. It's going to compare the actual blood pressure to the set point, and then it's going to make a decision by changing sympathetic tone and parasympathetic tone or activity. All right, so what was the initial response? Decrease in blood pressure. What do you think the medulla oblongata is going to do? Increase sympathetic tone and decrease parasympathetic tone. All right, so the medulla is going to send signals to vasoconstrict arterioles. All right, that increase, what's the effect of resistance when arterioles constrict, according to Poiseuille's law? Remember, radius to the fourth power, vasoconstriction, powerful way to increase resistance. And if resistance increases a lot, what's that going to be the effect on blood pressure? Increase, because they're directly related to each other. So that's going to bring blood pressure back up. All right, and how does that relate to the initial stimulus? Subtracts, so what kind of feedback loop is that? A nice negative feedback loop maintaining homeostasis. All right, let's go to the heart. So sympathetic nerves go to arterioles, but it also goes to the heart. What parts of the heart? Two parts of the heart. The conduction system as well as the contractile parts of the heart, the ventricles of the heart. It's going to increase heart rate. Oh, but what's left out over here? It's also going to increase stroke volume, right? So increasing sympathetic activity is going to increase heart rate plus stroke volume, because nerves go to the ventricles as well. And if you increase heart rate and stroke volume, what happens to blood pressure? Yeah, it dramatically increases blood pressure. And if you increase resistance at the same time, that's going to have even a more immediate and positive effect on blood pressure, right? Okay. So this is the baroreceptor reflex. So make sure that you can work through this diagram, okay? And I think the key equation, all right, to understanding all of this is this one right here. And you might want to be able to derive that. How would you derive it from? This cardiac output, okay, and the simple blood pressure and blood flow relationship right here, just by combining them, okay? But if you just memorize that for the test, you'll probably be good, I would guess. Because to me, it's not very intuitive, unless I work with the equations, that if you increase resistance, you increase blood pressure. Yeah, questions?
If you're taking the blood pressure of somebody who is laying down, it's lower than, compared to a person that is sitting. Why is that?
Lower compared to sitting. Blood pressure. Is that necessarily true? I don't know. I think they should both have normal blood pressure if they're not exercising. Okay? I think. Their blood pressure kind of should be the same. Now, when you measure blood pressure, we don't have real fancy ways of doing it, right? We put a pressure cuff around somebody's arm and we listen for some auscultatory sounds as blood is flapping through an artery right there. Okay? So the only way that you get really good blood pressure reading is if you put the cuff right at the same level of somebody's heart, okay? And because if you lift your arm up, there's going to be less blood pressure there just due to gravity. If you put your arm down, there's going to be more blood pressure there. So it's got to be at exactly the same level. So if somebody's sitting up compared to lying down and they're not exercising, the pressure reading should be, I would say, exactly the same as long as what? The pressure cuff is right at the level of the heart. When you're laying down, you're pretty much guaranteed it's going to be at the correct level. Right, but if you're sitting at a table with somebody's arm is up, it might be a little bit less. Or if their arm is down, it might be a little bit more. So there could be a lot of variation in somebody's blood pressure depending on exactly where you have that pressure cuff. Okay, and those pressure cuffs really give you only good information if you have the same person putting the pressure cuff on at the same time. Right, or if you do it at home, it's maybe not really accurate one single day, but if you look at your blood pressure over a number of days, you can see trends in blood pressure. I don't know if I would necessarily agree what the exact numbers are. But if you have to know what those exact numbers are, then I would use that mercury manometer and not use fancy electronics, but actually use somebody that's trained to hear the sounds and a mercury manometer, and that will give you the most accurate information. Okay. All right, where's that sign-in sheet at? You got it? Anybody need the sign-in sheet? No? You're good? All right, so let me see if I have anything for respiratory system. All right, let me give you a quick introduction to respiratory system. I think the first part of this maybe is just a bunch of anatomy, which you should probably know already. Screen options, pointer options, arrow options, visible. All right, so when we say respiratory, yeah, we'll get some of the orientation of the respiratory system down. When we say respiration, that's kind of a loaded term because it could mean biochemistry or it could mean actually the breathing. Right, which sometimes we refer to it as ventilation. So respiration really contains three related functions. Right, so ventilation, just moving air in and out of your lungs, and from anatomy you might remember some muscles that are necessary for inhalation, some muscles that are necessary for exhalation. We'll go over that again. Gas exchange between different air spaces in the blood, but also between tissue spaces and the blood. All right, so where can this gas exchange take place? If you were going to pick a particular structure in your body, where can gas exchange take place? Like capillaries, right? So capillaries in your lungs or capillaries in tissue spaces. So either pulmonary capillaries or systemic capillaries. And respiration can also refer to oxygen utilization, otherwise known as cellular respiration. Right? And so what's the point of cellular respiration? We spent weeks going over this. And what's the point of cellular respiration? It makes ATP. Some of you are smiling like that's really elementary right now. So what do you think? Did we spend too much time looking at that when we went over it? Should I cut it in half next semester? Go faster through it? Probably not. Okay. All right, so we're not going to spend a lot of time with cellular respiration because we're kind of experts in that area already. All right, so ventilation just means moving air in and out of your lungs for gas exchange in the lungs. All right, sometimes we might refer to that as external respiration. Okay, that includes gas exchange between the blood and tissues in systemic capillaries and O2 used by tissues. That's what we call internal respiration. All right. In all cases, gas exchange is passive. We can't like suck oxygen out of the air and force it into our bodies. It just has to want to go in there through natural processes. And what's the natural process that can move molecules from one place to another without the use of energy? Diffusion, right? Just due to a concentration gradient. All right. So all gas exchange moves due to diffusion. So if oxygen is moving into your body because you need oxygen to make ATP through cellular respiration, where is oxygen concentration the lowest? Inside your body or in the atmosphere? In your body or atmosphere? Where's the lowest? I just want to make sure I said it right. It's got to be low inside your body, right? Because otherwise oxygen wouldn't get in there. If it's high in your body, which way would oxygen go? It would leave, right? So that wouldn't be any good. Also consider carbon dioxide. We want to get rid of carbon dioxide. So where does carbon dioxide have to be low? Inside your body or in the air? It's got to be low in the air. And fortunately, in our planet, carbon dioxide is almost zero in the air. So carbon dioxide, how does carbon dioxide like to leave your body? Does it really like to leave your body or not really? The concentration gradient is huge because there's almost no carbon dioxide in the air. So it really loves to leave your body just by concentration gradient. All right, so to enhance or to allow that, there need to be certain structures. All right, so here we see a picture of part of the lower respiratory tract. Remember, the lower respiratory tract starts at the larynx, and we see trachea. Trachea bifurcates into primary bronchi, and then I see some secondary bronchi right here. All right, and then finally, and all of these bronchi have cartilage around them so that they're held open all the time, so that when there are pressure changes in the thorax that you need to move air in and out of your lungs, the bronchioles, trachea, don't collapse. Because if they collapse, what's going to happen to flow? And it's going to stop, right? Then you're going to choke to death. So these airways have to be held open with these cartilaginous rings. Okay. But when we get down to smaller and smaller structures, right, and we call these bronchioles, so we have terminal bronchioles right over here, and then they bifurcate into respiratory bronchioles, and there might be some capillaries associated with these respiratory bronchioles. So when you get into when air gets into a respiratory bronchiole, gas exchange can start to take place. And at the level of a bronchiole, you do not have any cartilage. You only have smooth muscle that can constrict or can dilate. And when a bronchiole constricts, what happens to air through that bronchiole when it constricts? How would you think about that? What happens to resistance of a tube when it constricts as the radius gets smaller? Okay. Then flow of air through that tube is going to decrease according to the fourth power rule. You can apply Poiseuille's equation to airflow through bronchioles that same way. So when somebody has bronchoconstriction, right, you need to use a beta 2 agonist to cause bronchial dilation so that they can start breathing again. Right? Remember, that's a beta 2 receptor, adrenergic receptor in bronchioles. All right, the functional and structural unit for gas exchange in the lung is what we call an alveolus. So here is an alveolus, and it kind of looks like a little berry or a grape. And you have about, it says 8 million alveolar sacs right here. I think it was more like 300 million. I'll have to look and see where that number came from. You have about 300 million of these alveolar sacs right here for gas exchange. So if we look at this alveolus underneath a microscope, it looks something like this. Oh yeah, 300 million alveoli. All right, so if we were to take a grape or an apple or an orange and peel it and take the skin of that apple and lay it down flat on the table and fill in all the little spaces, right, what could we measure of the skin that's covering an apple or an orange or a grape or something? We could measure the surface area, right, and we could just lay it flat. So we could take all of the alveoli in somebody's lungs, all 300 million of them, and lay it out flat on a table like this. The surface area would be, okay, about 70 square meters. So what's a meter? A meter is about this long. It would be 70 square meters, right? Which would be what? 2 times 3 would be 6, so like 30 meters by 2 meters. It's about the size of half of a tennis court. That would be the surface area. If we were to take all of those alveoli, lay it flat on the table. And so it's really nice that our lungs, for exchange, fit inside our thoracic cavity. Because if we just had a flat sheet of paper with blood on one side, air on the other, our lungs would have to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall. And I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court. Okay, it'd be really hard to get around. So that's the surface area for exchange. All right. So when I say surface area, I want you to be able to think of an everyday word for what surface area means. All right. So here I have a meter stick, and I'm going to measure the surface area of something. And we got something that's really easy to measure right here. All right. So what's the surface area of this doorway? Let's measure. Here it is. 1 meter. And what do we got? Exactly 2 meters, right? Exactly 2 meters. So that's one dimension. In order to measure surface area of this, what do we have to measure? One last thing. The width. What's the width of this door? Oh, look at that. How's that? It's amazing. It's exactly 1 meter. All right, so what's the surface area of this door right here? Yeah, it's 1 times 2, or 2 square meters. We could convert it to different units if you wanted to. All right, so that's the surface area of that doorway right there, 2 square meters. Now, how many people can get through that doorway at one time? 2, maybe? If you're trying really hard, 3? Nah, probably not 3. Probably 2. All right, but now let's think of a different doorway, a doorway that you have on your garage that your car goes in and out of. What's the surface area of that doorway? Is it 2? Oh, it's going to be 10 times this. Oh, that's probably okay. Because after I get done, well, maybe I'll click go away and come back later. Okay. All right, let's try to at least figure out what the surface area of a garage door is. Is it much more or less than a pedestrian door? It's much more. Maybe 10 times? No, 5 times, something like that. What about the number of people that can go through a garage door compared to a pedestrian door? It is what? Directly related to the surface area of that door. And as the surface area gets bigger, more people can go back and cross through that threshold, through the doorway right there. All right? So it's related to surface area. So when I say surface area for exchange, in your mind, I want you to think of, when I say surface area, I want you to think of, in everyday language, what concept? What's that thing over there? A doorway. Right, so think of doorway for surface area for exchange. So what's the doorway, what's the size of the doorway for gas exchange in our lungs? Is it big or small? Big. How big is it? Half of a tennis court. Right, so that's a huge doorway for exchange. And when you need a large surface area in your body for exchange, what does your body do? It folds things up, right? So maybe you have a filter at home. So here's the surface area of this piece of paper that's 8.5 by 11. Somebody could multiply that out. But if we wanted to get this into a smaller space, what can we do? Fold it up. Right? So that's really the function of all those alveoli inside your lungs. They have a special shape to them so that you have this huge surface area, but yet it fits in what? A really, really small space. And if you ever look at any filters in your car or at home or whatever, that's exactly what they do to allow air to exchange from one side to the other, but still fit in a small space, right, by folding it up. All right, so surface area is really the same thing as doorway. All right, think of that. Maybe I'll have that on the test. All right, so I think we're going to stop for today and start here next time. And have a nice Thanksgiving. Okay, see you guys later.